welcome to Data Science Perspectives. This series focuses on analytics and data science professionals from across industry to learn about how their career unfolded, what skills they look for when hiring, and what trends they think are coming next. I'm your host, Bill Franks. Let's get to it. Welcome to this episode of Data Science Perspectives. I'm your host, Bill Franks. Today, we're going to be joined by Colin Coleman, the Chief Data and Analytics Officer at Inspire Brands here in Atlanta. Colin and I first met a number of years back when he was still at Turner. He's been a longtime member of the Atlanta analytics community, having moved here all the way back in 1999. A lot of the analytical executives I talk to have interesting backgrounds, and Colin's is no exception. In fact, he is literally a rocket scientist by training. He began his career, in fact, as a research scientist for NASA before moving into the corporate world, where he's remained ever since. He started with companies like Fiserv and Turner in roles that involve both product and analytical components, but he migrated to more focus in analytics over time. After his final senior roles at Turner, he moved over to Equifax, where he served as both a vice president and senior vice president before recently moving to Inspire Brands as chief data and analytics officer. Now, many of you may not know Inspire Brands, the parent company, but I promise you know some of their brands. They include Arby's, Dunkin' Donuts, Jimmy John's, Sonic, and more. Colin has an undergraduate degree in aeronautical engineering from the University of Manchester in England, a master's in aerospace engineering from Georgia Tech, and a PhD in aeronautics and astronautics engineering from Stanford. And with that, let's welcome Colin to the show. Hey, Colin, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
One thing I often start out with is learning the interesting backgrounds of the analytics and data science execs I talk to. I have to say, you probably have one of the more interesting ones because you literally started as a rocket scientist, right? We tell jokes about this, but you were the rocket scientist. So how did you end up going from rocket science at NASA to the corporate world as a chief analytics officer?
Yeah, how long is your show? So I would say the biggest thing was realizing, well, go back, right? So being in aerospace and doing aerodynamic research, a lot of what we were doing was already modeling, right? We were simulating aerodynamic flows. We were forecasting what was going to happen with flows. And a lot of it was data, right? We were also flight testing and visualizing data and really getting involved in a lot of concepts. So I would say it was always kind of pre-wired. My interest with Vaux was really, I was based at NASA Ames out in the Bay Area. And so living in Mountain View and spending my time, you just can't but help being in Mountain View, soak it up. And I remember bringing up, to show my age, I was using a Mosaic browser on my Silicon Graphics workstation. And I brought up Yahoo when it was first coming out. And I remember sitting there in the lab at NASA going, that is the future, right? And unfortunately, I'm now over here in aerospace, so how do I get over there? So it took a while. I thought the way to do it was going to go to business school and get a degree in MIS. And then the dot-com boom happened. And I wound up just talking to a startup, actually in Atlanta, and had no intention of joining. And it was about commodity trading. So long story short, they showed me their demo and said, if you're interested, come back with some ideas of how you might help us. So I came back a week later, and it was all about traders trying to negotiate business deals in commodities. And I came back with a way of I would score all of the positions in the marketplace and how to show it graphically and how I would do it really fast in basically RAM back then. So then they were like, well, wait, instead of going to business school, do you want to join us and take a job in product management and lead our analytics side of the house? So that's how I never got the MBA. I kind of picked it up on the street and instead kind of went that route, right, into the companies. Yeah.
That's interesting, too, about your, you know, engineering background. How have you seen that engineering background? You've hinted at it already a little bit, but how does that help you, do you think, as you manage analytics teams? Because I think it's... I don't think it's as far different as people think, as you've already hinted at.
Yeah, I mean, I have a certain love of people that come up through the engineering ranks. because I think by its nature, engineering is that marriage of looking at the real world and how you model it and how you're going to simulate it. That's kind of the nature of engineering. And so at its core, you have to understand the real world problems, and then how are you going to model it? You know, and so that's kind of, at least for me in engineering research, that was the whole key of it. So I think engineers come to the table with that understanding of there is a real world at the end of the day. I've met a lot of people that have come up through data science, through statistics and other backgrounds, right? And they're all about the math, and they fail at really understanding, having the empathy of what is the real business problem that's going on. And I think engineering sort of starts with the real world problem and then moves into, okay, what's the right solution?
I like that. That's a good point. You know, you mentioned your first job already, that when you left Ames, you know, helping run the product for that company. Some of your earlier roles were a little more on the product and marketing side, a little more like what you might think someone might do with an MBA. But then over time, you kept shifting further and further into analytics. So I guess, how do you think those earlier roles drew you into analytics, and what made you decide to kind of go in all on analytics all the way after a period of time?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, if I look back in the career, I always feel like I have been in that. It was almost being back in the chief data officer path, even before it was called that, because I think the thing I was struck on was what attracted me was this marriage, kind of like thinking like the engineer, right? The marriage between the real world, the business side, and then what did you have to do from a technology perspective, or the nuts and bolts, the programming to make it happen. And so the product management side, what I was never drawn to I didn't want to be the brand manager. It was always more the technical product manager aspect of what I was interested in, because I wanted to have the marriage of the two. And so I sort of grew up always in that space, one foot on the business side, one foot on the technology. It was always about the analytics and all about how do you build the capabilities. But then you had to understand the actual analytics of what you were doing to make sure it was going to provide some value. So I think the product management, you know, again, on that sort of, if you're on the more technical side, it does feel more like engineering to a degree.
Yeah, like the perspective is interesting too about, you know, bringing that real world view in, and then as you're working on those products, you know, there's that more business side, and then the more technical side of it. I think, I guess in my own head, you've kind of reframed my thinking a little bit. I always think of product managers as more, you know, pure business managing the product, but you're right. There are a lot, especially if it's a technology oriented product, there's tons of technical details they have to worry about as they manage that product. It's not just deciding what are the latest features going to be and how are we going to market it and so forth, right?
Right.
So as you've worked across not only multiple companies, but multiple industries, you've probably seen a little bit of similarities and differences in terms of some of the challenges that those different companies face. Just curious if you have any perspective now that you've been multiple places. So are there some things you just say, no matter where I go, I know I'm going to see these same exact problems or these same exact opportunities at this point?
To a degree. I mean, I would say, let me take a step back. I mean, I think for me, I've gravitated towards these roles, which are, there's a shared service, if you like, going on across a larger enterprise. So multiple stakeholders. And then we're trying to do common platform plays, which also invokes then a common approach. You want to use the data and analytics to really take advantage of the platform. It's not just about cost savings. It's about how to innovate. That's what we did back in Fiserv. It's what we did at Turner, definitely what we did at Equifax, and now what we're trying to do here at Inspire Brands. So from that perspective, there's a certain setup that looks very similar. I mean, you're always going to walk in, and there's always going to be the full spectrum of things from data governance all the way up through strategy, right? You're always going to have that collision of multiple stakeholders and priorities. But I think the key that I enjoy is what are those things that we can do at scale across the organization that sort of falls in that path of a shared service model so that we can create once and use in multiple places across the board. That's probably more of a delivery mindset. But I would say that's something for me that's always been key. I think leading a lot of the places I've worked also have had a consumer focus. And so actually leading with the consumer, it seems such an obvious thing. But some places are very focused on the lagging indicators of the business success and not so focused on the consumer journey, the consumer experience. But that's so key. And so I would say those are sort of common things I'm looking for. I mean, and then obviously the use into operation aspects that we're doing to reduce costs. So I'm not sure if I answered your question. I think that's more the things that that have been resonating common themes across my career.
Well, I'll be honest though. I think just take the shared service, you know, the idea of creating something that's a shared service that can be reused and scaled. You know, that's something I think companies are in demand for today. And you know, probably when you first started getting into that, that wasn't necessarily the standard operating procedure. So, you know, when you look back at, you know, how you rose up through the ranks over time, I'm guessing part of it was you were pushing that concept before it was one of the big things out there. And back to your real world example, you're saying, I don't just want to build the cool analytics. I really want to think about how we're going to be able to scale it and then get it out there for multiple people to use. That's widely accepted today. If I go back, you know, 10 or 15 years, even, I don't think that was widely accepted, at least not in the kind of large companies that you've worked in and I've worked in out in the marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was fortunate that first job I had in the startup was all about back then e-markets, right? And that was all about the hub and spoke approach to analytics. And so the pattern has been sort of repeated. It's almost a platform play. And that's been repeated across multiple companies that I've worked in.
So what would you say your approach is when it comes to managing your teams in terms of the style you have, both as you manage the team to get the work done, but also as you, you know, advocate across the organization to try and get the funding and the support for the various things that you're doing?
Boy, I would say there's quite a few things involved there. Just on a personal basis, I think we had this discussion earlier, making sure that everybody understands the bigger picture of what we're trying to achieve. A lot of people, if you get in certain corners of analytics, they're just dealing with the day to day. So understanding the bigger picture and the vision of what we're trying to achieve is key. I'm very big on, if you've read like Good to Great, getting the right people on the bus, heading in the right direction, or at least getting the right people on the bus, period, to figure out where we're going. I'll spend a lot more time with trying to make sure that we have the right people and the selection. And also, maybe I it's just the way one of my extremes are, but I will view my role as a manager as really like the staff are my customers. So I want to make sure that that we're keeping them engaged, that we're tuning in with what the staff really wants in terms of their career development. And that means both the projects they get, the trainings they get, really understand the motivation. So I'll push big on my managers to make sure they're in tune with their staff. That really helps us with making sure, one, it's a great experience all around, that we can align what an employee wants with what the company needs. But also, two, when we start talking about retention in a highly competitive marketplace, even if we're not paying the most, a lot of times if someone is coming to work, I always say there's three reasons why someone comes to work, right? It's the mission, the leader, or compensation. And a lot of times, if you get two of the three, you're doing pretty well. Well, I want all three, right? And I think that gets back to, are you able to align what somebody wants from that career with what the company needs? So I think if we've got that, those are pretty key things. We had a discussion yesterday, actually, with our data science team. And it was really more about, so what is it you guys want to do? Like, what is it that motivates you? What demotivates you? Because I don't want to be asking people or setting up a culture of work where that just doesn't align with what we want as a company or what they want. Now, other than that, I think trying to provide opportunities for people. I will push the management team also on good churn versus bad churn. And what I mean by that is good churn is when you know what somebody wants from a career and it comes a time when it's time for them to leave the group. move to a different company, whatever, and we all celebrate it because we know it's time. Bad churn is 2 weeks notice and they never really tell you why. Right. And so the goal for my, and I'm like, change is inevitable. People are going to leave over time, but let's have more good churn than bad churn. And then what happens is if we're focused on good churn, people tend to be reengaged and we're moving people around and we're increasing their responsibilities.
I love the point about viewing staff as customers. I don't think I've heard anyone phrase it that way before, but I think it's a really, really interesting viewpoint that if executed well, I could see it really would lead to these things you're talking about in terms of keeping the right employees because you're focusing on what they need so much. Outside of this philosophy that you just described, which I'm sure has been part of what's helped you be successful, are there any specific one or two traits that you think have really been behind your ability to work your way up the ladder over the years?
I don't know. Other than I perseverance. no, I mean, I think for me, what I enjoy is, and it probably gets back to just the nature of maybe how my brain works. Somebody called it the Medici effect, the family behind the Renaissance. And so for me, what I enjoy doing is I've cut across multiple industries. You know, I've not just been in financial services all my life. I've not just been in restaurants. And so for me, that is kind of interesting. It's the ability to take something that you've learned from a particular industry or a certain approach and then walk into a different industry, and then be able to, there's a whole new set of problems and some things can be applied. But the really interesting thing, the whole Medici effect is the innovation occurs at the intersection of pre-existing ideas. It's kind of like the whole Google product design team philosophy, right? Bring together people from different backgrounds, put them together. And so if you're coming into a new environment with ideas that you've had from whatever, and you can see how to apply it, you can see the intersections. So that kind of multiplies how things can be applied. So I have personally found that to be very advantageous in the long run. The price is you have to learn a whole new domain. So there's near term a hit to do that because you're trying to learn a whole new industry. And then long term, you can kind of see patterns that overlap and similar and new things come about as a result of that. And it makes it more interesting over a career, right?
Well, you won't get an argument from me on that one. Having spent so much time in the consulting space where I got to work with a lot of industries, I think it's one of those things. I don't know that there's a right or wrong answer, but I think any given individual, you either are going to love and have to pursue that variety, or you're going to want, to go really deep. And we need both types, I guess, to make business, to make businesses succeed. But right. I've always loved getting to dig into new areas myself, in new industries. So, as you think about then, you've tried to drive some innovation and some change in multiple industries, as you just talked about, over time. What have you found to be some of the hardest parts about actually getting that to work? Is it getting the buy-in from the people or the mechanics of actually doing the work? What has caused you the most pain over the years?
Yeah, I think, and a large part of it, a lot of these have been large organizations. I think it's easier when it's, there's five of you in a startup. But larger organizations by their nature just have a lot of people. I know that sounds obvious, but a lot of people with conflicting priorities of what they want to achieve. And so that you feel that in terms of strategy. And it just depends upon what the operating mode is of the company. But I think a lot of it is just buy-in. A lot of it comes down to relationships. A lot of it comes down to people wanting to trust what you're advocating. And then, of course, it's alignment with what the business stakeholders. You see that in terms of funding. You see that in terms of resourcing and what it takes to sort of advance certain ideas. I think it's easier to incubate things within a data and analytics space, but to actually then move that into innovation stance or move it actually into production usually means you have to start with the business idea and you're working with them, rather than try to throw it over the wall. So that has been very successful, as opposed to just, I've cooked something up in the corner and here, please take it.
I wonder too, kind of how there's some similarities across industries we've talked about. A lot of times, you know, some of the things you talked about, I don't know, it would be that much different if you worked on the creative team developing the advertising copy in a way, right? I mean, there's certain
Right.
processes and certain approaches when you're trying to convince a large number of people in a large organization to do something different, particularly if they weren't inclined to do so. I don't know that, I mean, it's all definitely real for data science, but I don't know that it's unique to data science, I guess is where I'm coming
Mm-hmm.
from.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of similarities. I think that's the, as one progresses through the career, I mean, you start seeing similar patterns across the board.
When you look back now, after having worked for a while, is there one thing that you wish someone had told you before you started working that you ended up learning the really hard way?
Many things. They say, right, that not just the mistakes. I wish I had somebody take me to one side, because when I started off going to college and, you know, starting off at NASA, I was very blinded, if you like, by what I wanted to do, right? I was very much just focused on that. And I was surprised, maybe I shouldn't have been, as I progressed, that that's not the way the world works. And my interests would change over time. I, as a person, will change over time. And obviously the work environment is constantly changing. So the ability to be aware of that and to always kind of come back periodically and check with, you know, what are my interests today versus what were they 5 years ago? What's of interest to me and how to apply that? And just know that, you know, that book about who moved my cheese, the cheese is going to get constantly moved in terms of both the work environment, but also I think the surprising thing was for me. And so I think I again, going back to the advice I give the team is, understanding what's of value to you and then how to align that with the work environment. So given where I started and where I am now, it's so different. That was totally surprising to me.
And I think too, the idea that you mentioned about reassessing where you are and what you want to do in mm-hmm. points of time, because it will change. You know, you're right about that. I can weave a story about how I went from where I started to where I am right now today. And it sounds like this cohesive, planned out story when you hear it looking back, hindsight 2020. But there were a number of the components of that story that at the time came out of nowhere, were random, weren't anticipated. You know, I jumped at an opportunity that came my way, or I passed up an opportunity, and things evolved from there. And it kind of ends up making sense. But if you're not looking for those changes and you're just going straight ahead at what you wanted, you could end up in a job that is a bad fit for you, even though it was mm-hmm. at one point a really good fit. And I don't think that's a good spot for people to get in their career.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I am surprised. And the other thing I think too is getting older, having kids and so forth, right? My objective function changes over time.
Yeah.
When I was younger, it was all about the career, right? So other things come and go about what I want. People call it a work-life balance, but it's like, but what are the other things that matter? And so how does this play into that? Am I prepared to move across country while the kids are in school, right? Do I want to spend all my time doing this at work when I want to be doing this at home? And those are hard things to answer until you're faced with it. So, I mean, I think it applies to just in terms of what you're doing work-wise.
It's in the objective function. It is funny how it changes like that, because I know when I was young and single and I got the chance to move out to San Francisco for both a promotion and a raise, I'm like, well, why wouldn't I do this? This is a no-brainer. Of
Right.
course I'll move for a promotion and a raise out to California. Whereas now, you know, with kids and having, you know, settled down in an area, that's a huge decision today. I mean, I suppose it's possible I could be convinced to do it for the right thing, but it wouldn't be just the no-brainer as long as it was a promotion and money, I'll go, because there's so many other things. I love that you tied it to an objective function. Very analytically appropriate term there.
Well, I mean, the last thing I'll say is people are shocked I'm shocked when I say I've been in Atlanta for 25 years.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know how long we thought we'd been in Atlanta when we moved here, but we had the kids here. And I've been fortunate to have enough opportunities to continue to grow. But, you know, but we had that discussion about, do we want to move? Oh, of course we would for the right opportunity. But I think at the end of the day, the family and our style of life was, you know, we had to be in balance, right? And so again, but now our kids have gone to college, right? But it's still, now it's a different objective function that we're after. And so it's going to keep changing along the way.
Well, let's finish. There's one question I'd love to get people's perspectives on, which ties to looking forward. We've kind of looked back at your career, you know, looking at some of what you're doing today. Mm-hmm. What are one or two of the biggest trends that you think in the next, let's say, 3 to 5 years from now? And I know it's impossible to predict completely, but what are some of the things coming our way that you think are going to be where companies are really focused in the years ahead?
Well, again, it depends upon the industry and maturity, right? But I mean, when we think about a lot of the analytics, we think about a lot of the AI and you know, the evolution of AI over time and how we're sort of evolving out of, you have to be dunked in data science to take advantage of AI. So as we're moving, creating these apps, we're creating companies like, you know, Data IQ, or moving beyond that, right? Where anybody now can get access into an AI data set. So I think the unleashing, if you like, the power of AI across the board will become more commonplace, and it won't just be beholden of a certain set of data scientists will still be needed, but I think their role will evolve as well, right, over time. And then what you'll see as that, looking within even the company, how we connect then what could have been islands of functionality into a system of functionality. So there is a network of AI, if you like, that's working and humming. We're dealing with that right now between, you know, revenue management, supply chain, staffing, you know, all from an operational, and it's all got to synchronize, right? And so the problem, just when you figure out one little area, now you've got to figure out the whole network. So.
Yeah, I think if anyone doubts that some of what you said could come true, I know early in my career, we weren't called data scientists yet and so forth, but even basic reporting tools didn't exist. When you wanted a report, you would come to someone like me and I would have to go custom code, then custom format and provide that report. And maybe I could rerun it for you on a weekly basis, but it was manual. So even that basic stuff used to be very much a technical exercise. And over time, we were able to standardize it, able to scale it. Now there's tools that let people create amazing things quickly. So, you know, there's really no reason, CRM packages, embedded modeling, some of the basic modeling procedures. So to me, it does seem natural that AI will similarly become diffused out within other tools and then people's attention, whatever the next thing is. There's always something new, right? We weren't out of job when reporting tools came out. In fact, if anything, we were happy because we didn't have to spend so much time building reports. And I think there's always that kind of an opportunity if you're willing to look at it that way.
Yeah. So that's what I was saying. I think the role of data scientists, I think, still have to understand how to build it and understand what's in the box. But I think the role of data scientists will evolve over time, even into, well, how is that actually applied to real life and how these various systems come together?
Well, I appreciate you taking some time out of your busy schedule today. I think you have some great insights for folks, and I definitely appreciate you joining me on the show today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was great to chat with you.